Blog Talk Radio.
See that 2 weeks in a row I hit my cue. See, every now and again, I'm on time. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Dig it, man. It's week two of nose breathing again. I promise you, it sounds petty. It may sound uninteresting, but I promise it is nothing like breathing through your nose comfortably after not doing so for over a week or about, right about a week, whatever. It was the most fun. And God, oh, the pain. You have no idea how sensitive your nose is until something actually happens. So you dig where I'm coming from, but that's a different story for a different time. Happy anniversary. We are 11 years in, and it is an amazing accomplishment. Again, I credit the dedication to everyone who has graced the mic and joined me on these Saturday mornings. I credit the dedication, the persistence of Rodney to get me even back into this fold. If you're a new listener, it will be a very short story, but the story goes, I worked in corporate radio before. It was good to me, but it wasn't, the coins weren't there, I'll say that. And it's different when you do it for yourself, because even when the coins aren't there, you can claim a whole lot of shit in your taxes, so it works. And it's been very beneficial over the years. Trust me, it's been very, very beneficial over the years. So I'm just grateful to continue to have the desire to do it. I'm grateful to all the guests throughout the years. I posted a couple of days ago, Talib Kweli's birthday happened, and I posted a picture of him. And there's a story behind that picture, and it's not crazy, so I'll share it. So he and I had forged a relationship on Twitter. So it was my birthday, and I decided to do something I had never done before. I decided to do like the whole month for my birthday. Like, you know, that's some old stuff that most women talk about, but I had never done it. So Run DMC was performing in Raleigh. So I flew in to that, and he was performing as well. So he and I linked up. Now, during his set, there was some issues, so he and I were talking. Well, while we were talking, people in the crowd started taking notice. So they, you know, I had people running up on me like, yo, is it okay if I get a picture with Talib? And I was like, yeah, you as manager, so I figured, what? And like four or five people asked me that. It was just crazy. So, that was good. That was really good. It was absolutely hilarious. We talked about it afterwards. And then it just so happened the following week he was in Baltimore. And that didn't work out for other reasons and stuff. But it worked out because that's when I got the drop that we play on the show from him and Styles P. So we had a very short interaction there. But again, there was some extenuating circumstances of that one, but I got to meet Styles. So it still worked out in my favor. So it was crazy, man. Just crazy. But, you know, 11 years. Thank you to Rashi, Rodney, Thomas, Miss K, to T Ham, to Cuz Vic, to Brian Green, to, you know, absolutely, you can never forget Audra. Yeah, you can never forget Audra. You know what I'm saying? Just everybody who has made sure that this thing has gone off when I got stuck or, you know, I forgot that my shit was still on mute and I was talking and, you know, dead air kills me. Like, dead air is never where you want to be in radio. So, and again, to all the guests, Thomas, I don't know if you remember this one or not, but we had a brother in South Africa reporting from the funeral procession for Nelson Mandela. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we had, it was crazy. Like I knew somebody that knew somebody. They was like, yo, blah, blah, blah. They was like, yo, you want my man to come on the show? I was like, fuck, yeah. Because he has to do it for work. So, yeah, it makes sense. So the brother called in through, what's that app or whatever? Skype. He called in through Skype, and we had him on. It was crazy. It was crazy. The sister that came on in the beginning, she did she collected bras and then sent them to Africa so the women could sell them so they could make their own money. I'm just trying to think of the sister that came on like 2 weeks ago with her story. I mean, it's been so many people. There have been so many stories, you know, from the people that you know to the people that you don't know. It doesn't matter. The fact of it is we all have a story to tell, and this is a safe place for people to come and tell their stories.
I mean,
unless
don't forget Andrew Wang, right? We had Andrew Wang, okay, political.
We had, that's why I said, you know, people you know and people you don't know, right? But again, I was saying this is a safe place unless you talking about that damn makeup. Makeup is the devil. I'm telling you, it is the devil. Now, Rashi, you always talk about what is it that we can tell men? There ain't nothing.
We don't particularly care for men with them little Elvis Presley heels on, them little lifters on like that or whatever. We don't say nothing about no man in lifters. We just let them be. Let him have on high heel cowboy boots. He'll be all right.
What are you talking about? Ain't no man out here wearing no daggone high heel cowboy boots. But it's the sisters out here with this daggone makeup.
I just saw some the other day. Not a heel like a woman's heel, but the boot heel is more than six. Them is lifters. Them is high heel boots.
Okay.
Anyway, we don't really care much for, like, we just got into the beard. The beard is okay, but when it's, like, hair on your excessive body, we don't be into that, but we don't ask y'all to shave nothing. We just rub on that, you know, nappy taco meat and keep it pushing. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
We do not necessarily care for how men talk about us when they get together. But since we ain't there, it is what it is. But men, private speech about women between men is malignant. But, I mean, it is what it is because I don't particularly care for how women talk about men when we get along either. There are things that both of us have. But the makeup, I have to say, not only is it the devil, it is, in fact, dangerous. It's women with lights in their eyelashes.
Yes.
They got bugs crawling around under that wig in between them braids that they didn't had up for months because they just keep laying that lace front wig on top. There are actual animalcules crawling in between the plaits under them wigs. You heard me? You understand? They booty this. I mean, these things we're doing to these things we are doing in order to appear aesthetically pleasing. We never we never found out the origin of the aesthetic. So now people are able to switch it up. Like the makeup we do now is not the makeup of the 90s. I don't hardly see nobody with black eyeliner under their eye no more. But when I grew up, you could max out a whole pencil in a week just putting that black film right there under your eye, right? This is what's getting me. Do you know how expensive it is to create that facade?
No.
Let me let you know. Rihanna's makeup line, you're not finna buy no concealer for less than 40. A little one, it's like 4 ounce. It's not even 4 ounces. It's like 3 ounce. It's enough to where you can keep it in your bag if you're going through the airport. Okay? That little thing right there is almost like $50 to $100. Okay? That little piece, where she said, it's just a little piece of stuff that you put under your eye. Her lipstick, $35 to $50. The good lashes, just the lashes, not the installment of the lashes, just the purchase good mink lashes, $30-something, $40. The install, $30, especially if they're doing individual lashes and not strips. It could be even more than that. I don't know because I won't let them poke me in the eye. Man, don't even talk about getting our mustaches waxed off, getting our chins tweezed. It is a fountain of money that... that I don't think people understand. So when she thinks she cute,
we don't
she
understand.
Better think she cute. She better because she has spent upwards of $200 to $300 on product to create that facade. So get at them like they casket ready. To me, it's like preparing yourself for death. Like this is what I want to look like on my last day.
Okay.
And I say
okay.
on my last day, you're going to look down in that casket at regular old bloated ass, tired from these kids wearing her down with her Frederick Douglass afro, Rashid. I am not, I'm definitely not about to put it in my will to pay that mortician to do anything unless it's like something mangled my face, right? But if it ain't. You know, if it ain't where my nose is, where my chin is and all that, then they going to catch the, you know, and whenever I see these women, Lee, that's what I think about. I think about, dang, she ready to die. She ready to be put in the ground. She's so caked up. And so there's
no,
what I'm worried about
when I see them is what they look like when that stuff is off their face. Cause that shit ain't cute. I'm sorry. You know, if you coming out the house with 5-10 pounds of makeup, I got questions. I got questions of who are you really? Because I don't know if you were born a male or a female. If you're with me, then, you know, hopefully you were born a female. Also, I don't know whom I'm talking to because, shit, I could look at you tonight and wake up beside somebody totally different in the morning. I'm confused. I don't need that in my life. I'm too old for that. I'm getting to the age now where I got to start worrying about my heart, my palpitations. This is not cool.
But we don't like that white chalk line y'all doing either. You know what I'm talking about? Lee, that white chalk line y'all putting on top of y'all beard where you outline your features.
No.
You don't know what I'm talking about?
No.
Thomas Berry, you know what I'm talking about.
What'd
you say,
Thomas?
But barbers,
Marley's
that's right. They come out of there with the highlight concealer, the white concealing line around their beard. We ain't on that either, but we don't say nothing. We good.
But the barber's supposed to take that off by the time you walk out. That's not supposed to be on your face when you walk out. Yeah,
people with money go to barbers. That's why we we yielding to Brother Barry right now because he got money. I ain't got no money. Poor people like me, I cut my hair with a butter knife and some margarine. You know what I'm talking about? I'm like a steak knife and some margarine. That's how I cut my hair. Like, I ain't got no money for all that stuff.
But I believe in you, Lee, because I believe what you're saying is true. Because when you, if your face ain't real, if your actual, because the first impression you get is what people see, right? And if that is not right, it's not true to your actual nature, then you get to cascade a whole bunch of fake shit on from there. It don't have to be your real name. That ain't your real waistline. That ain't how tall you are. That ain't your hair. This ain't your, you know, this ain't your real age. You actually 60, not 35. You actually poor, not middle class. You actually got an associate's degree, not a master's degree. You actually understand, you can start playing all kind of games when the first game you play is, this is what I look like, but it's not actually what you look like.
Right.
So let me push back on y'all a little bit. I think that we kind of confuse makeup and costuming. I think that's where things are kind of like blended.
I think you guys
are talking about costuming where people are looking totally different. But I also believe that this is what happens when an industry that's supposed to be done for women is being done by men.
By men.
Whether they're straight or gay, a man really doesn't know really intimately how a woman should look. Women should be leading that. Just like men should be leading how a man should look for men. And when you look at the makeup industry or the beauty industry, it's no accident that some women look like drag queens and some drag queens look like women. They're all going to the same place with the same outline, same color structure. Some women, especially sisters, are naturally just beautiful. And when you look at the makeup almost, it's more like a disguise. Facial structure, the nose structure with the makeup looks different. the cheek, they say that highlighting or bringing these things out. And when you really look at it without the makeup on, you can see that really they're changing the structures of these sisters' faces. And so for me, I like my women with barely any makeup on. I'm not an anti-makeup person, but I think y'all talking about costuming, these people look like they're about to rob a bank.
They look like they work for, it's almost theater, because there's two ways to do makeup. You can do makeup just for day-to-day usage, right? And then there's a theater or operatic makeup where you exaggerate the contrast and you, so that somebody sitting in row 20 back there in the back can still get a little bit of your features while you perform. And these people are walking out in actor's makeup. You understand? Almost like we back imitating drag queens. You know how drag queens used to be or consider themselves to be a artistic form of womanhood. We actually look like the people who are artistically emulating us. And I'm like, why would you come out looking like you cosplaying being a woman, but you are a woman. So that's my concern, really. Not only that, but they ready to pay for that makeup. But when you pack that stuff on your pores every day, you have to have another set of money. And that's your permanent skincare regimen, right? Or else you end up with them craters in your face like Lawrence Fishburne, all right? So there's a whole another part of that they not doing. They not washing them lashes. They pull the strip off. The strip falls off because they don't know how to put them on right. And then they don't even rinse them or put no alcohol or nothing on them. They just glue them back on their eye again. It's not right. It's the way we doing it. I don't even mind how tranny we look. My concern is that this has to come with another routine. If you a guy who like your head bald and you shave a lot, you can't just shave. You got to put that, You got to put some shit on there afterwards, right, Thomas? Or else you'll have, you'll be looking like a star, your hair to look like Star Crunch. You have to put all this. Huh?
No, that's very true. You got to really put, you got to put some oil on afterwards. You got to even do some pre, you know, you got to make sure your hair is moisturized. People are not even supposed to be shaving their head bald, to be honest.
Okay, so this is it. They wearing locks, right? But they not getting the locks retwisted. They just letting the locks map together, talking about they are real Rasta. And up underneath them locks is enough fungus to actually have them lose the hair. We go on into the trend. We sign up for it wholeheartedly, just like black women did with weaves back, you know, just like we did with perm. And they was making the perm out of potato lye. And now I got a fleet of black women in their 60s and 70s where you can see their thoughts. When they come to me, they ready for me to cover up their scalp. But it's too late. You done got 12 potato lye perms and burned your scalp to high heaven. Now you want to come back after. We sign up for trends and things. We don't have the full complement of care afterwards. And we suffer in the consequences, going blind with hair glue in our eye socket. You understand? Going, having heart attacks and dying from the silicone busting, okay? The booty stitches, the stitches they used to pick my booty up fell out. And now I got one up booty and one low booty. We cannot maintain these alterations we doing. And so we suffering from the aesthetic.
Now, at times like this, right, when we're engaged in conversation and Rodney is extremely quiet, and I always say, like, what Rodney sits back like, what the hell is where did this come from? Rodney, I think I shared the video, but it was a video of this sister, and she wasn't an attractive young lady. She put that daggone makeup on, and it was like, oh, wow, okay. Okay, nice. But then this morning, I saw a picture of Little Kim. And the caption of the picture was, Little Kim was an extremely attractive young lady. And she was. Little Kim was just so freaking naturally pretty. And to see her now, see what she did to herself, it's just sad. And that adds on to... Normally, I try to hop on Thomas' show in the morning, support the brother just like he supports us, right? And they were talking about how the family dynamic has shifted. And I understand how, as in life, with all things change. It's okay. You know, it's okay. But to the extreme that we go with some change is the challenge. You know what I'm saying? Because there are rules and boundaries for a reason. And everything should not be discarded and thrown away. Some things are very necessary in order to keep structure, order, and balance. And when those rules have been made to come across like it is keeping you down or stagnating your growth, you get people rebelling, and they rebel so hard that censor is very much forgotten. And though there tends to be huge consequences. You know, yes, you have a right to self-expression. Yes, you have a right to a whole lot of things. But there's a responsibility with those rights that I don't think many people think about. I don't think many people, as they go about their daily, realize how impactful their decisions are upon other people. You know, there are a myriad of things that can happen based off of this one slightly different choice that you made in the day. Because you made this choice, this, that, and that happened. But had you modified that choice just by a fraction, it could have gone totally, the rest of your day could have gone totally different. I'll put myself in that category. So
I've been riding dirt. Man, I had to get my daggone car registered like a mofo. You know what I'm saying? And I did it. I did it this week. Now, no time have I been riding dirty that, and my tag just expired at the beginning of the month. But seriously, at no time had a cop gotten behind me at all. I was fine. Hold on. Until last night. Last night, a cop gets literally on my tail. And I'm just sitting tripping because I had just put the new sticker on the car the day before. And I'm like, man, I'm so grateful how things worked out. Because I'm too old for that crap at this thing. Like, I don't want those problems. I don't need those problems. I'm just trying to live, let live, influence as much and as many people as I possibly can influence, and you know, just be easy with it, you know. And yes, Rodney, you're absolutely right. Timing is everything. I said that the timers this morning because he said something about, you know, you could receive a message, but that message may not be heard. And I was like, you know, timing is, you may not be in time with the message that you receive from your mate. You know what I mean? You could very well get great advice from your mate, but if you're not in a place or a space where you can receive that message, because, again, your timing is off, and you're not going to actualize on that message in that moment. It's going to take a little while. And this is where we have to still believe in one another. We have to push forward as a unit in order to get beyond today, beyond this moment, to the next thing. You dig where I'm coming from? So, yeah, that's what it's all about, bro. That's what it was all about, honestly. I mean, as we are a show that's based on current events and the news and all that type stuff, Israel got attacked last night by Hamas from the Gaza Strip. You know, we could have talked about this, that, but then stuff like that happens. It's like, oh, which way are we going to go this morning? It's all about time. It's all about time. Yes, sir. Hold on. I'm going to get Rodney in because our guest is on. What you say about the van, Rodney? I want you to tell us. Don't put that in the chat. Put that out in public. What did you say?
I said the van is coming due for its smog check and registration this month, and I got my fingers crossed. I'm on bended knee because I need to get one more year out of it, and at 320,000+ miles, you know, every year is always questionable.
Thomas, say what you said.
Time for Rodney to put the van in hospice.
Y'all better leave Tasia alone, baby. Topia, what's the van's name? I named her Topia, but I know that ain't right. What's that van's name?
Why are y'all hating on the gray goat?
I didn't
I
hate
it.
I said I named it Topia. That's what I'm saying.
I will get another job to get you another car, bro. I saw a car around the corner for $5,000. I will make a way to buy that mug to get you another car, bro. Like, let it go, right? you
hey,
can't
but as long as it's running, you don't have to, nobody has to spend any money. That monthly payment, brother.
That's
that
true.
Money,
that's
right.
True. But in a minute, they might be getting you for emissions or something, though, because don't it kick out like 1980s air from the back or something?
See, there you go. There you go.
Oh my God.
Hey, it passes every year.
If you made it to Kansas City in that bad boy, I'd hop right in it, and we could drive it straight to get it, you know, serviced or whatever. Because, you know, but this is what y'all don't know.
No.
Mr. Rodney
is
taking care of that van.
Off.
That van ain't no ran down side chicken here. He been changing out oil and transmission. He been putting new spark plugs and new cables on there. So
Rashi, the guest is on. I don't want to go too long. I agree. We can come back to that on the other end. You are asking.
We don't have
to come back to
yourself.
We
don't have to.
Come back. Look, we started the GoFundMe officially today. We are going to get Rodney a new car. So, you know what? I'm with that. I'm going to do a GoFundMe page today. We are going to get Rodney a new car. Yes. I'm sorry.
Give him a new thing.
I'm sorry.
2005 and still going strong.
Okay. Mrs. Sales, good morning, sir. How are you? Thanks for getting up with us. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a history maker on with us this morning, good friend of Rodney. And when I came out for Rodney's birthday party, Mr. Sales was in the building with his new wife. The young couple were together, you know, they say about 25, 28. Well, you're about 28, Mr. Sales, right? Your wife's about 20, 25, 23? Which one is it?
Well, I'll only tell my age. I'm 64.
Okay,
so
you're about 28. Okay. they were in the building to celebrate Rodney's special occasion with us. And then Rodney goes into this whole litany about the brother and his history and how he's a historical figure in Major League Baseball. And I'm like, yo, like, how has he never been on the show? Like, it's October. I love baseball, okay? I am a baseball fanatic. I say this time and again. I had a neighbor when I was about, because I was like in the first grade. So I was like 6, 7 years old. And he used to sit on the porch, which is AM, FM radio, and listen to the Baltimore Orioles play day in and day out. I don't know if that cat has ever been to a game, but I know he sat on that porch and listened to those games day in and day out. And I would sit there with him and listen to that broadcast. And it really came home to me. I was raised by a single mom, and my mother didn't know how to play basketball. But she knew how to play baseball. She knew how to play football, so she taught us how to play, my brother and I, how to play football and baseball. Well, as a kid, you know, I just love baseball. As an adult, I still love baseball. My Orioles been getting their butt kicked for a long time, but it's October. We're still playing. So the hunt in October is on. I'm going for a pennant. I won't say the World Series. Them Braves are in Atlanta. Good Lord. I don't know what they got in the water down there, but them boys are balling. They are balling. They are healthy. They got some great pitching. Their bats stay alive. Their defense is good. They are a problem, a real problem. But I at least go for the pennant. If we get the pennant, I'll be happy with that. And if you don't understand baseball terminology, the pennant is the divisional championship in baseball. And then the World Series is the championship between both divisions. So right now we clinched the AL East title, which is good because 2 years ago we were damn sure in the basement. We were at 100 losses and 40-something, 50-something wins. So it was awesome to be in this position right now. And I said, now Buck Showalter, if you're not familiar, I know I'm bouncing around a little bit. I'm going to get to it. He was the manager of the Orioles. He got fired, released, whatever. He also got fired from the Mets this year. The Mets spent a whole lot of money on building that organization. And I'm going to tell you all right now, if they keep the nucleus of that organization, give them next year, maybe the year after, and they'll be in the hunt as well. Because Buck has a tendency of being able to build a great club, but he just can't get you over the finish line. But that cat can build a great club. He can build a great farm. I don't know who scouts for him, but he has great scouts. He is a beast at building an organization. He just cannot get you over the hump. But I don't want to go too far down the pipe. I want to talk about Mr. Sales. He was drafted out of San Diego State University. Out of San Diego State University. But he was college teammate for Tony Gwynn and Karen Danley. He then went on to, for one season, he played for San Diego Padres, changed 1983 with the Miami Marlins. He appeared in 81 games. He transitioned from a player to a trainer with the Padres chain. He was the head athletic trainer for the Las Vegas Stars from 1993 to 1997, and then moved to the Oakland Athletics as assistant major league trainer from 1998 to 2007. And in 2008, he was promoted to the head trainer. He was picked as one of two American League trainers for the 2009 All-Star Game. How was that, Mickey Sale? How was being at the All-Star
Game? That was the mountaintop. I loved going to the All-Star Game because watching the All-Star Game growing up, and even while I was in the game, that was just some place I wanted to be. And I got the opportunity to go there, met the president, Barack Obama, while I was there.
Okay.
Just touched everything. It touched every button. It was a great honor.
What made you choose baseball?
Well, I love baseball. I started playing baseball when I was 7 years old. And
there you go.
I played baseball and football growing up, but I played football just to wait around to do something until baseball season started. Played baseball in high school. I played baseball in college. I got the opportunity to play minor league baseball. I got hurt, so that kind of ended that dream. Cool. But I just had to figure out another way to get to the big leagues.
There you go. I love the fact that you never gave up. You know what I'm saying? Who were your inspirations, you know, coming up as a kid?
Wow. Good question. Inspiration in the game. I just love the game.
Gotcha. What made you love the game, though? What made you love the game?
Well, I think because it was a game I could play, and I wasn't bad at it. And so to be able to get better, you want to watch good examples. And, you know, why not just watch the best? And growing up in San Diego, we had a Major League Baseball team there. So I could, you know, and the tickets were very cheap. You can get a ticket to a Padre game for $1. You know, maybe sometimes a dollar was hard to come by, but you can catch the bus down there to the stadium. I would go to try to get in as many Padre games as I could, and then I'd watch, you know, back then only one game came on a week. You know, it was the Saturday game of the game of the week. And you'd watch that. So, yeah. And you just tried to watch as much as you could to get better and watch how the big leaguers did it. And I was just fascinated by the game and the game within the game. And so I kind of gravitated towards baseball more when I got into college, because my father sat me down and had a talk with me and said, which one do you want to play? And I said, I'd like to try to play both. And he said, well, you know, as great as that might be, he said, I think there's less injuries in baseball. And I said, I kind of agreed with him. So I dropped football when I got out of college. And I just played baseball.
And we definitely got to touch on that piece, but I want to continue the game within the game and the passion for the game. I think what burns me with people is, you know, folks talk about how slow baseball is and how boring it is. You know, I'm like, I don't get what you all don't get. Like, this is a strategy thing. You know what I'm saying? Not only that, if you're at a game and you're in the stands, it really isn't about the game. It's a social event. You go to more socialize than anything. Football is more than bad. Like, you're at a football game, you are tuned all the way into that daggone game. For the most part, you really dislike the people that are not rooting for your team. Baseball, it's really about the game. Yeah, you love your team, but it's about the game, the beauty in the game and how it's executed. You know, a foul ball is coming back and everyone's trying to catch it. You're not just trying to catch it from your team. You're trying to catch a foul ball, period, because it's about the game. Has that love always been a motivating thing for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can honestly say I went to a lot of baseball games. I never caught a foul ball. Disappointing thing because, you know, I used to go, everybody, when you take your glove, everybody wanted a foul ball.
Yeah,
but
I agree.
Watching the game itself, just my love of the game comes from the strategy of the game. Watching the players line up on the outfield, seeing, you know, how they move for every hitter. Watching the pitcher, when he pitches, setting up a hitter with different pitches, fastball, changeup, curveball, slider. Just watching them set the pitches. One of the greatest games I ever watched was a game on TV, and Greg Maddux was pitching, and they had the center field camera on, and just watching him set up hitters. It was amazing what he did. He was a surgeon, and some people just can't get into that aspect of the game. I could. So that made me enjoy a baseball game a lot more than someone that was just there to see runs scored, you know, homers hit, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that's where my love came from. I was a student of the game.
So you got hurt.
Yes.
Your dream of getting called up faded. That's okay. But you stayed with it. You transitioned from a player to personnel. Yeah, I mean, you still made it to the majors. You know what I'm saying? Like, how was that when you got that phone call?
Well, yeah, you know, everybody that plays baseball, their dream is to play in the big leagues. My dream was no different when I played in the big leagues. When I signed with the Padres out of San Diego State, I was sent to long season minor league baseball in Miami, Florida. This is back in 1983. I know this is going to, you know, for some people this is going to sound a long time ago, but for me it seems like it was yesterday. But went and played minor league ball in the Florida State League in Miami, Florida. And it was funny because, you know, back then there was a minimum maximum that you could make playing baseball. And I made $600 a month playing minor league baseball in Miami, Florida. So you want to talk about struggle to survive, you know, while you're playing baseball. And so I dislocated my shoulder.
How many people did you live with?
Huh?
How many people did you live with?
There were three of us. Well, four of us in an apartment. You had to have roommates. There were four.
Absolutely.
And we lived on Jiffy Cornbread, Steakums, and any sandwiches we could make. That was our life for that summer. And so that was fun. It was fun. We were young. You know, I was 21 years old, you know, living in a different part of the country I'd never been to before. It was an adventure. You know, it's funny. We traveled all throughout Florida. I mean, you know, we'd travel up to Daytona Beach. We traveled down to, you know, Miami. I was in Miami, you know, Fort Lauderdale. Did I see some? Yes. Was it aggressive? No. It wasn't aggressive. I don't know if it was because we were there to do what we were there to do. I mean, you know, we're in Fort Myers, Florida. And I can't say that I ran into any problems. And I'm going to tell you what, maybe I was just the naive West Coast, you know, guy that didn't notice it. I can't ever say I was ever called the N-word the whole time I was down there. I can't say I was ever denied service. I can't say I was ever looked at rudely. I was a pretty good-sized guy back then. I was 21, 22 years old. I was in my prime. But I don't know if that would stop, you know, what was going on because, you know, racism is racism. I don't care who you are.
Okay. Brother Sales, this is Rashi. How are you doing this morning?
Good. How are you?
All right. I had a question about your transition into training. To me, that seems almost, did it feel at all like you were, did you have to go in and learn? Did you have to become a student again? Because, you know, kinesthesiology is not something you just learn to do. When you get ready to work with kinetics, when you get ready to work with the anatomy and physiology of the human body, oftentimes people in those positions have medical degrees.
Yeah.
So, well, how did that transition work for you? And did you feel at all like you was just trying to hold on to an old girlfriend? You know, you can't be with her, but you're still showing up for Thanksgiving, and you talk to her mama all the time. And you understand
right.
what I'm saying, where you just kind of, were you just trying to kind of hold on to that, the feeling that baseball gave you when you transitioned, or was that a natural transition for you? Like maybe you had minored in sciences or something as a collegiate youth.
Yeah, well, you know, it was, as far as the girlfriend analogy goes, just trying to find another way to get her. I mean, she was still out there. I still wanted to get her. So I went to San Diego State as a pre-med major. And along school lines, I was playing baseball there. And I will have to say that I'm going to go out on the line here and say baseball is one of the hardest sports to play and go to school, because you play almost every day. At least we did, and studying. So I was talking to my pre-med advisor, and I said, this is really difficult playing baseball. And she had asked me, well, are you going to give up baseball? And I said, no, I'm never going to give up baseball. And she said, well, maybe we should change your major. And I said, okay, knowing mom and dad were going to be a little disappointed. But I said, what do you suggest? She said, well, I'm going to go introduce you to someone. And she took me to the athletic training room and introduced me to the head trainer at the time. His name was Bob Moore. And she told him that I was a pre-med major that was getting overwhelmed playing baseball and with my caseload. I said, and she thought that athletic training would keep me in the medicine field and maybe allow me a little more free time to play baseball. And so, you know what, I looked at the curriculum and everything, and I said, this is perfect. And I was even thinking ahead then at that time, because I was saying, you know, they have athletic trainers in sports. This would allow me to stay in sports. So I became an athletic training major, got through school, left right after my senior year before graduation to go play in the minor leagues. And then when I came back from playing, I graduated, started graduate school, as a matter of fact. Started graduate school, had a year and a quarter of graduate school under my belt when I got offered a job by the San Diego Padres, who I had played for, and they knew me, and they knew what I was doing, and they called me and asked me if I wanted that athletic training job in Spokane, Washington, for their minor league team in rookie ball. In 1985, and I jumped at the chance. I left the graduate program, San Diego State, said, I think I need to work more than I need my master's degree.
Okay, and it's time to get those work hours in, okay?
Yeah, it's time. Yeah,
not time to get me.
Tired of that $600. Come on with it.
That's it.
Well, Even my first contract as an athletic trainer, and you know, this is why, you know, they say, why aren't there more people getting into this, especially black people getting into this this field? Well, my first contract as an athletic trainer in 1985, it was short season A ball, so for three months, and I made $1,000 a month. So it was, you know, when you start at the bottom, you start at the bottom. They call it, they don't call it the bushes for nothing. You know?
Yeah, right.
Knowing that you played the sport, sometimes those trainers, they haven't actually been out there. They haven't slid in and bumped their hip real hard or, you understand, or twisted their back out trying to crack
mm-hmm.
the bat. You know what I'm saying? So they don't know. They know the human body, but they don't know how to modify in order to get maximum, usage out of the body while you're at play. So did you have the trust of those players? They were clearly ready to pay you and are still probably ready to pay you quite well for your expertise. But did the players themselves trust that you knew what you were doing, you know, when you were advising them and telling them how to do your training, you know, to do the work of training them?
Well, yeah. Well, as an athletic trainer, our jobs are sports rehabilitation, evaluation of sports injuries. And when I started in the rookie leagues, guys knew I had played the game because I wasn't that far removed from it. As a matter of fact, I went to work for the Padres, the same organization that I played for. So when I showed up that next spring training as a trainer, athletic trainer, and not a player, you know, the players would come into the training room and look at me and go, "What are you doing in here? Why aren't you out there?" And they say, "Well, I retired from that. I'm gonna do this." And so they knew I played the game, and I think that did help them relax more with me and gravitate towards me and give me their trust a little bit more, because they'd say, you know, they say things like, "You know, you played the game, you know what this is like, you know what this is." And I go, "Yeah, and now I know how to fix it." So I think, yeah, it did give me an advantage, because like, I'm only one of, I think, two guys that actually became major league trainers that actually played minor league baseball. The other one was John Adams. He was the head trainer for the Seattle Mariners. He played in the minor leagues. And then there was me. I played in the minor leagues. So I was one of two that I still know of that actually played the game. So it's,
all right. So,
it's helped a lot.
So you're a hot shot guy out there. I know there are a trail of women out there saying, "Your daddy is Mr. Sales. I know it is, Mr. Sales. I know it is." How popular were you out there?
It's funny, only because you really have to know me. That wasn't my focus. When I get focused on something, I get a little tunnel vision. And my focus wasn't to be in Spokane, Washington, or Wichita, Kansas, or even, you know, Las Vegas, Nevada. Those are the cities that I worked in, or Charleston, South Carolina. My focus was to get to the big leagues. And I even try to tell guys that I know that go to the minor leagues that playing, look, don't get hung up on the things that are going on in those cities, because that's not the big leagues. And you have to focus on your final destination, which is the major leagues, because there's nothing like the major leagues. If you think the girls and everything that's coming after you in A-ball are good, wait until you catch the ones that are coming after you in the big leagues. So, yeah, that wasn't really my focus. And I did what I have to do to get to the major leagues. That was my focus.
I want to continue down that line as far as the transition from the minors to the majors. So the money, because you talked about the 300, then you went to 1,000. We also talked about injuries being a factor along the way. I think one of the things that discourages young folks from getting into baseball is they don't understand the money. Like, football is flashy, basketball is flashy, you get millions and millions of dollars in a very short span of time. But you can play baseball forever, and that money is forever. That money will last you and your family for a very long time. Do you feel that Major League Baseball is missing the mark in recruiting young folks, specifically young black folks, in the game? Partially because of that, and they put more emphasis on Latin America, Central America, than they have bringing homegrown talent in via the U.S.
Well, I know MLB has programs. They have the RBI program, Reviving Baseball in the Inner Cities, that they use. Matter of fact, I was just it was funny you were talking about Atlanta. One of my best friends in the game, George Pulis, he's the head trainer for the Braves, and I was just talking to him the other night, congratulating them on going to the playoffs and, you know, hoping they win another World Series. I know.
Don't do that. My Warriors got to win.
This is my boy, and I you know, so I'm trying to, you know.
Nothing against him, but maybe have a flu for like 2 weeks. Two weeks of food on him, spreading around the clubhouse, so I have at least a chance.
Hey, if it gets in there, definitely will spread. But talking to him, he said that an event had just ended in Atlanta where Major League Baseball had come in and brought in, you know, some of the retired players and coaches and managers to Atlanta. And he said they had an event where they were playing, they put these leagues together. And he said the talent was incredible at this event. And he says, in Major League Baseball, if you've ever been to a Major League Baseball event, they do things right. They go all out. And they said this event, he said this event was incredible. So it was a Reviving Baseball in the Inner Cities League that they put together. And they bring all these black players, young black players in to play in this league. And they said that it was an incredible event. The talent was incredible. So we're out there. The black kids are out there. They're playing. They're getting lured away maybe by the basketball and the football, maybe the better athletes. But the kids are falling back in love with baseball, I think. But they just have to realize, the money's not there right away. You might, unless you get drafted in the first five rounds, your signing bonuses are going to be very much. Then when you go out to play, salaries have improved. I mean, you know, I'm talking from 1983 to 2023. Salaries have improved in the minor leagues, but you're still not going to, you know, be able to even raise your family on those salaries. But when you get to the big leagues, all your contracts are guaranteed, every penny of it. Once you sign your name on that dotted line, I don't care if you go fall down a flight of stairs, they owe you that money. So the contracts are guaranteed. And the minimum for a Major League Baseball player, I think this year, it's somewhere around $600,000 a year. And that's the least they can pay you. That's the 25th guy. He's making $600,000. So, I mean, that's a pretty good salary. But it might take you a little while to get to that money. And you do have to go through the minor leagues. And I think that's where we lose them, because the money in basketball and the money in football is immediate. As soon as you get out of college, you're straight in the show. Whereas baseball, you're not. You go from college to the minor leagues. I think that's where they get lost.
Why is there a minor league baseball? Because they're the only – well, that's not true. The G League now in the NBA. But
right.
For the most part, if you're drafted, you're going to play in the league. If you
make
the training camp.
Well, baseball is a highly skilled game. And you just can't go from – there's only been a few guys that could ever go from college or to, you know, college to the major leagues, or from high school to the major leagues. I mean, you look at a guy like Ken Griffey Jr., who's a very special talent. He got to the big leagues when he was 19, 20 years old. Alex Rodriguez, very special talent, got to the big leagues when he was 20 years old. You know, Dave Winfield went from the University of Minnesota to the San Diego Padres starting lineup. But
big win.
Those guys are special. Yeah, those guys are special. You just can't do that in baseball. Guys have to learn how to play the game at a major league level. They have to learn and see what a major league pitch looks like, because it's hugely different from college pitch to a major league pitch, or a minor league pitch to a major league pitch. There is a huge difference in what that pitcher can make that ball do. So you need to get used to the lifestyle, and then you have to play 162 games. That's a big schedule.
A lot of games. That's a lot of games.
You got to get used to doing that. I mean, in minor leagues, we played 144. And I was in the minor leagues for 15 years, in the big leagues for 13 years. And so 144 games, and then you get to the big leagues, and they tack on those last 18 games. Those last 18 games are the killer. Those are the ones that you've been doing this since April. It's now September, and you're tired. You gotta have a special mentality to keep grudging on after that. And you're playing almost every day. So it's grueling. You gotta be able to do that too.
What was your sideline addiction? Were you a sunflower seed dude? Are you a chewing gum guy?
She took my question.
I'll tell you. I was actually, and I started to have it in college. I was actually a smokeless tobacco user. I did it in college.
You was eating snuff? You was chewing snuff?
Yeah, I did. I did it in college. I did it in my minor league days.
Sweet baby Jesus. Sweet baby
Major league days. It's just a habit you picked up because as a person that just came to the game and watched, you needed something to do. I don't like chewing gum, and I wasn't a big sunflower seed eater.
No, you do like gum, Mr. Sales. You like tobacco flavored gum.
Yeah. I don't know if that'd be very good, but yeah, that was just something to do over the next 3 hours while I was at the ballpark. So
okay,
that was my sideline.
Last question. Hold on, please.
Okay.
I want to talk back in the day. I want to talk Monarchs. I want to talk back in the day, okay? Do you have a Satchel Paige, I can't remember all the names, but do you have one of those for yourself?
Mine is that lady called
the Peanut. Her name was Peanut, and she was the only lady to play in those times, but around men. Do you know who I'm talking about?
I've heard vaguely of those, but you want to talk about the Negro League. And here's the thing. We had a lot of days where they honored in Major League Baseball, where they honored the Negro Leagues and you wear throwback uniforms. They'd wear the Kansas City Monarch uniform for those days. And Major League Baseball has gotten more involved with the Negro League and lifting it up. And maybe one day they'll include a lot of these black players into, you know, that didn't make it to the major leagues. They'll include them into the Hall of Fame. I think they will. I think that's coming soon, that they're going to put Josh Gibson, you know, and those guys in the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame because they belong there. They should get the recognition. And I think they're getting closer and closer to doing that. But yeah, I have some old style hats and some old style tops and things
like that.
When we have our throwback days,
is Gibson your go to dude from that day, or is there another person who really embodies that spirit of Negro? Is baseball the Negro in the baseball, the Negro in the bat? You know.
Yeah, I mean, well, if you look at. Yeah, we had Jackie Robinson, who played in the Negro Leagues and broke the color line. You had Satchel Paige, who pitched, in the Negro Leagues and actually got the chance to pitch, in the major leagues and pitched well at an advanced age. And I know there's a lot more players that deserve the recognition that they even played in the Negro Leagues. I mean, my cousin had a father-in-law who pitched in the Negro Leagues. My cousin's uncle, Earl Wilson, is one of the Black Aces, was one of the Black Aces. So, I mean, I can reach back and try to really find that one go-to player that I had. But I'd have to say, it's like everybody else is Satchel Paige because he got the most pub from anybody because he actually played in Major League Baseball.
Thank you. All right, Lee. I'm done.
Hey, Mr. Sparrows, how you doing? This is Thomas Berry. I wanted
Good.
To ask about Tony Gwynn. And some stories about him because Tony was just one of those great baseball players who played for the Padres. Do you have any stories about him? How was he as a, as a guy off the field? Because I know he was a great guy on the field.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I knew Tony. Me and Tony met in 79 at San Diego State. And we became friends right away. I mean, it was amazing how quickly we did become friends. And we roomed together on road trips when the baseball team would travel. Me and him would always room together. And I always remember this one story. There's a lot of them, believe me. But this one story always comes to mind. And it was our junior year. And we were playing the regionals in the NCAA regionals in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And this was in 1981. We were going to play in the regionals. And Tulsa, Oklahoma at Oral Roberts University. And we were in the hotel. And I'm laying in the room. I think I'm watching Soul Train or something that's on the TV. And everybody's got their doors open on the floor because we have the floor. And all of a sudden you hear this thumping coming down the hall. Like it sounds like just a herd of horses running down the hall. And Tony comes running around the corner into the room, and he jumps on the bed, and he's jumping on the bed, and he's all excited because Tony got real excited about stuff. He's all excited, and he flops down on the bed, and he looks at me, and he goes, "Dude, the draft is tomorrow. I got to get drafted." And I said, "What?" He said, "I got to get drafted." And it kind of ticked me off when he said that because you had to understand the season he had just had. He's in college baseball, come on off playing basketball, and he had like 425 with about 8 homers, a bunch of RBIs, and he's looking across at me going, "I got to get drafted," you know. And I'm looking at him going, "You've got to get drafted." He said, "I got to get drafted," you know. And he goes, I go, "Dude, you're getting drafted." And he goes, "I don't know, man. They don't think I can throw. They don't think I'm very good on defense. You know, all they think I do is hit." And I said, "Man," I said, "you are really crazy. I said, you're going to get drafted. Don't even worry about it." But he was actually really worried about getting drafted that year. And he didn't think he was going to go high enough in the draft. He was Padres' first pick in the third round. He should have went sooner. I know a lot of teams would kick themselves in the butt for not drafting him earlier. But, yeah, he was the Padres' first pick, but they didn't have a pick that year to the third round. And people don't realize that Tony Gwynn was a third-round draft choice.
And man, I didn't. I thought he would have been a first-round. He was such a legend.
He should have been
played so long.
He did.
But, yeah, he was a third-round draft choice.
Why do you think he was slept on? Because of what he said?
Because they didn't think he could throw. Because Tony was the point guard on the basketball team at San Diego State.
Yeah. Yep.
So we'd be playing baseball probably about a month before he made it, before basketball season ended, and he actually was able to come out. But we knew that, you know, as soon as he came out, he was going to step on the field. And which, you know, and he did. And it wouldn't be nothing for him to come straight off the basketball court, suit up for him, and go out and get 3 hits that day. And hadn't picked up a bat all year. That's how good of a hitter he was. I mean, this guy was just a natural, just an incredibly natural hitter. I mean, best hitter I've ever seen. I'll just lay that out right there. And I've seen a lot of hitters in my career. 29 years in the game, I saw a lot of hitters. He's the best I ever saw. And people can't argue with me on that one. I mean, this guy, we had a game. You want to hear another story? We were playing a game against, I think it was United States International University. It was one of our local schools in San Diego that, you know, we were playing a game. And we were outside warming up before the game. We were on the field warming up before the game. And they were taking batting practice, and somebody hit a line drive down the left field line and hit Tony in the mouth. And so he's laying on the ground, and he's bleeding, and the trainers come over, and he's got to go to the hospital and get stitches. So they take Tony to the hospital to get stitches in his mouth. We're playing the game. He gets back around the 8th inning, and we actually are losing to this team. And our head coach, Deets, is like losing his mind because there's no way we're supposed to lose these guys. And so in the bottom of the eighth inning. Tony comes walking in, mouth full of galls, just got stitches, and Deitch told him, "You're hitting." Everybody in the dugout, looked, this guy just got back from the hospital.
Like, what?
"You're hitting." Yeah, told him, "You're hitting." He had sutures in his mouth, you know, just got stitched up, and he said, "You're hitting." And Tony got up there, and he had a two-run homer. I mean, it was incredible to see. He just got up there and hit a two-run homer. And we won the game. And I said, this guy, not only could he get out of bed, he can get straight off the operating table and hit. That's how incredible. That's how incredible of a hitter he was. I mean, just great to watch, great to see. And all you did was sit there and wonder and go, how is he doing it? You know? And so, yeah, there's a lot of stories about him. Stories, but that one's one of my favorites because him hitting that homer to help us win the game with stitches in his mouth, mouth packed with galls, that was something else. And that's another
Ryan,
thing.
You have
a tough shot. People don't know about him. He's a tough dude. He's a tough dude. Tony didn't play either. We played summer league ball together, and we're in the outfield. I'm center, and he's in left. And the team that we're playing, we don't get along with really well. So our pitcher hits one of their players, and he charges the mound. And me and Tony start running in. And we're running in. I'm running in from center. He's running in from left. And I go to the pile, and I grab a guy off the pile. And we're wrestling around. But I look to my right, and Tony is just squared up with this guy, throwing lefts and rights. So, I remember Tony's from Long Beach. He went to Long Beach College. And people don't realize that because he's such a nice guy. He was squared up with this guy. And I said, "Are you?" I said, "Wow, that's Tony." And so he was just, he had your back, too, as far as he was a nice guy, but he had your back.
That's Ryan, you got any questions?
What's going on, Steven? Good to hear you on the air with Lee and the rest of the fellas. You know, I was a baseball player back on the streets of Brooklyn, New York, played stick ball, played stoop ball. If it had ball in it, I played it. I played in the fields in North Carolina when we was knocking them apples around. Really enjoyed it as a child. I'll say baseball changed my life because when I played in New York on the restore team, my coach wanted all of us who were right-hand dominant to bat left-handed and learn how to throw left-handed. Hmm. And he said he was probably ahead of his time because he said it would make us more flexible as a player mentally. And, of course, as kids, the coach said, do it, so we did it. And when I started playing basketball, I remember sometime being up in the air and my left and right hand was trying to decide which one was going to actually get the wrist action to flick the ball. So one of the things I wondered was, did you notice a difference in left-handed hitters versus right-handed hitters? And if so, what was that difference? And then I want you to tell some stories about Moneyball, Blue Moon Odom, and Vita Blue, if you can.
Okay, thanks. Well, left-handed hitters just have such nicer swings than right-handed hitters. And I think it's because they can fall off the box and start running to first base easier than right-handed hitters. But, I mean, if you look at the predominance of right-handed pitchers in the league, compared to left-handed pitchers, left-handed hitters have an advantage in baseball because, you know, there's mostly right-handed pitchers. But as far as the swings go, I don't know why left develops such beautiful swings, but they do. There's some ugly ones, but if you could take the prettiest right-handed swing and compare it to just take a Ken Griffey Jr., the guy's swing was beautiful. It's, you know, and there's no right-hander that swings like that. And it's because we fall away from first base, they fall towards first base. And there's just some artistry in that. And they just take it to the next level in the major leagues with the beauty of it. And if you look at most of your great hitters, they're left-handed, you know. And so I don't know why. I can't say there's a reason for it other than it just seems like a more natural side to hit from. But left-handed hitters are – and I was a right-handed hitter. But left-handed hitters, in my opinion, are, you know, they tend to be better hitters than right-handers.
So what did the pitchers – and I know I gave you two other questions, but real quick, how did the right-handed pitchers feel about left-handed hitters? Because I remember when I played and I would come to bat, the pitchers didn't always look as enthusiastic when I stepped up.
It's – the way they look at it is – left-handed hitters could see the ball better from a right-handed pitcher. Because if you played the game and you're a right-handed hitter, everything's coming towards you. The right-handed motion is coming towards you. But if you're on the left side of the box, it's coming from the other side. So
yep.
You have a longer time to look at it. And so, you know, they know that they get to look at the ball longer. Left-handed hitters do from a right-handed pitcher. And the more you get, the longer you get to look at the ball, the better your chance of hitting it. And so that's why you try to pick it up as soon as you can. And the left-handed hitter could just pick up the ball a little bit sooner than the right-hander can because of the way they're watching it come in. And they had a longer time to look at it, which is why I think they're better hitters naturally. But so – I don't know. That's just my theory. You know, I ain't never been in a lab or, you know, or anything like that. I'm just looking at it with my eyes, and that's what I see.
You convinced me, man. I wrote it down. I'm convinced.
Okay. So, Stephen, tell us a little bit. You know, you played with some of the greats and or was associated with some of the greats, coaches, owners, players. You know, I'm kind of an old school baseball guy. So when I think about the A's or the Athletics, I think about people like Vida Blue, Blue Moon Odom. What kind of players were they? What kind of people were they? Did you have any association with them? Did you learn anything from them?
Well, to tell you the truth, the A's were probably the worst at bringing old players back. And I don't know why. I don't understand why, with all the great players they did have, we didn't see – the Yankees are probably the best at it, and the A's, I would have to say, are probably the worst at it. But whenever we went to Anaheim to play the Angels, when I was the assistant, Larry Davis was my head trainer, and he had been in the – he just retired, as a matter of fact. This year, after having 50 some odd years with the A's, that's how long he worked.
Wow.
Yeah, he worked there a long time, and he just retired from the A's as he was. They took him up to the front office, but he was there when Blue Moon Odom was there, and so when we go to Anaheim, Moon would come into the training room all the time and just sit and talk to us, and you know I saw him pitch on TV when I was younger and things like that, but just sitting down and talking to him and seeing him as a person, and I'm going to tell you that he's the nicest man ever. This guy was a gentleman. This guy just was one of the nicest people I met in the game. He'd come in every series, every day for every series, and he'd sit down, and he just – we compare, you know, we talk about the modern baseball player at that time compared to when he played. And, you know, and the takeaway from that would be, you know how Deion is hot right now and he uses the word dog a lot?
Yep.
Okay, we'll say – we'll take it back about 20, 30 years. And he would say the player, and we're talking about the players of the 90s and the player of the 2000s, and we're saying, you know what, they don't have the dog in them like the player of the 70s and the 80s, you know, and the players of the 2000s are saying that probably about these players now, that they don't have that dog in them. Because for some reason, well, we know the reason, money beats dog out of you. Money beats dog out of you. It's you get money, some of that dog leaves because that dog ain't as hungry as that dog was when he first got there. And I think if you're not as hungry, you just don't go as hard. And I think no matter how you try, it was like, you know, if you remember the movie Rocky, and he asked his manager what happened, and he said, you became civilized. And that's what happens. And it's unavoidable because you've got a lot on the line when you sign that contract. And I'm not saying they don't play hard. They play hard, but they don't have that dog anymore. That dog is gone. And I don't think you can get that back once it's gone, because I don't think you can get to that level anymore, because that money has civilized you. And that dog is just gone. Just, you know, you ain't getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning no more to go run that mile before you go work out. You know, you might have moved back to 6 o'clock. You're still running that mile, but you ain't running it at 3 anymore. You're running it at 6, you know, because that dog got you up at 3. Civilization gets you up to 6. And I think that's something we lose with these guys making all this money. And don't get me wrong, more power to them. They deserve it. They put their bodies out there and they risk, you know, irreparable harm doing the things that they do. So they deserve the money, but money changes you as an athlete, I think. I don't see anybody that money hasn't changed or knocked the dog out of them a little bit. It just happens. And sometimes I don't even think they realize it.
I want to pick up. Go ahead, Brian.
I just wanted to ask about another one of my favorites was Vida Blue. What was it like being around him or seeing him, and did you learn anything from him?
Well, I didn't get to talk to Vida a lot. Met him a few times. But my biggest takeaway from him is when I was young, watching Vida Blue pitch and watching him stand on that mound, he was bigger than life to me. When this guy looked like he was 6'8". You know, about had that nice V shape coming up out of that uniform and just that wind up and throw. And then I actually met him. And Vida was like 5'10". You know, Vida was about, you know, might have been a little bit shorter than me. But I remember him when he pitched for the A's, and he was just so much bigger than life. And he stood up there with such power. And, you know, and just the way he threw the ball, but he wasn't a big guy. And I said, man, this guy filled up the screen when I was watching him. But he was another very nice man, very intelligent, very, very knowledgeable about the game, could speak to anybody. But like I said, the A's weren't very good at bringing back players to visit or coach or guest coach. The only one they really brought back was Ricky, you know. And Ricky's awesome. Ricky's an awesome teacher, great teacher. But you think they do it more, you know, but they just didn't. I don't know the reasons, but they didn't.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate you sharing some of my favorites. Go ahead, Lee.
So when you said irreparable damage, you know, I don't want to get folks to fall sense that it's all guns. Well, it's all roses and cupcakes on the baseball end, because there are serious injuries that occur. What's the most serious injury you had to deal with as a trainer?
Well, pop out in my mind. One was in the minor leagues, and the other one was in the major leagues. I had a player got hit square in the face with a 90 some odd mile an hour fastball. And when I got there, his jaw was broken and his hard palate had been fractured. So that's kind of emergent. And you have to really know what you're doing to take care of this guy and get him immediate medical treatment. And then the aftercare that he has to go through with the repair of his jaw and the repair of his hard palate. And you have to monitor that. It's not a lot of things in athletic training you have to do, but you have, you know, keep wounds cleaned, and you have to, you know, make sure that he's doing the right things, you know, to help his healing. And then the second one was, this was in my first year in the big leagues. We were playing a day game, and a kid named Jason McDonald was playing left field, and Ricky Henderson was in center. And there was the ball hitting the gap, and they both converged on it. And Jason dove, and Ricky didn't hear him call for it, and he ran smack dab into him and knocked him unconscious out on the field. So I'm running out to the field, and I've got two men down. And I've got one guy unconscious, and you got Ricky Henderson laying down hurt in center. So as I'm running by Ricky, I yell, "Are you okay?" And he goes, "I'm all right." And so I have to go take care of, because I have to go take care of the unconscious guy, first priority. So I run out and I get to Jason, and he's out cold. He's unconscious. So you just stabilize him. You make your signal for to get the ambulance on the field, because you don't even play around with an unconscious person. You make sure that he's got a clear airway. You hold tight until the EMTs get there, and then you let the EMTs do their thing. These are guys mm-hmm. that do this every day, and you let them do their thing. Mm-hmm. And you more or less take instruction from someone that's done this, that puts people on stretchers and transports them every day, to you who, mm-hmm. you know, are a first responder, but you don't do transport. So you just kind of listen to their instruction and what they want you to do. But those are the two worst injuries that I saw. Unconscious person on the field is pretty serious.
And last question, because it's almost our time to let you go. Going back to the question that Rodney asked, but I think it got missed. Moneyball, why didn't it work in Oakland?
But it did. It worked. See, this is the premise that Billy goes on. The premise was, you have the best season that you can have, and the playoffs are just the playoffs. The playoffs are happenstance. You get as far in the playoffs as you're going to get. So as long as we were having great seasons and making the playoffs, then the playoffs are the crapshoot. You know, it's best two out of three, best five out of seven. So you. It's what it is, but we are four out of seven. But we made the playoffs. I mean, I was in the major leagues for 13 years. I made the playoffs, what, five, six times out of those 13 years. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Never got to the World Series. Why? Because we didn't have that one extra oomph. I mean, in 2001, we had the best pitching staff in baseball. We had good players. We had American League MVP. We had what we needed, but we made mistakes, and that's why. And that's the part that Moneyball doesn't, you know, Sabermetrics doesn't tie in. There's always going to be that human factor. There's always going to be that element that's uncontrollable, that's unpredictable, and Moneyball couldn't predict that. Can't predict somebody coming to the ballpark maybe not feeling that well that day, or somebody coming to the ballpark after they just had a fight with their wife and now they got to go play baseball, or somebody coming to the ballpark that just ain't feeling like playing that day. You know, the numbers could say what he's supposed to do, but there's that human element that you can never take out of that equation. So, but I mean, I think it worked. I think it did what it was supposed to do. No, we didn't win the World Series, but we got to the playoffs and we had winning teams, you know. Like you said, playoffs crapshoot. Anybody can win playoffs. That's in the playoffs. So.
Yeah. Okay. What have you been doing now that you're out of baseball?
The best. I think that's the best. <thing I've ever done.
laughs> I like it. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. That's what's up. That's what's up.
Yeah, I'm not really watching the game as much as I used to. I watch the playoffs. Like, the playoffs are starting. I'll start watching a little bit of baseball right now. I just got married, so I'm trying to you know, be a good husband, you know, and be there for my wife while she's doing what she's doing with her life, because she's still working. So So I'm going to be there for her while she's doing what she's doing. But me, I wake up every day and say, what today? And I enjoy that. And when I don't enjoy that anymore, then maybe I'll go out and find something to do. But right now I enjoy waking up going, what today?
So with this program and it's
Lee, don't let him fool the brother cook.
Right. Let me bridge this. So with this program in Atlanta bringing back baseball in the city, is there a chance that Las Vegas may see something? Maybe.
Well, I mean, they do grant proposals for, you know, they have, and I think they might be open for grant proposals. I think Las Vegas is a very prime place for them to do that, especially if the A's are coming here. I think the door is wide open for them, for MLB to come in and do something with the youth of Las Vegas and possibly, you know, because they build stadiums. They know fields. I'm going to say stadiums. They build baseball fields. And facilities.
So, is there a potential ambassador in on this?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Is there a potential ambassador in on this? I'm thinking.
I would have no trouble picking up that banner. I know some people there. Am I the one to bring it home? I don't know. You have to get started to see, you know, if you can bring that home. I make no promises. Mm-hmm. You know, if I don't make any promises, I can't break any promises.
There you go. Well, brother, I want to thank you for your time. I mean, this is magnificent. Again, having a
meeting
that I missed was a very great bonus. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm telling you, I'm sitting there, he's doing the introduction to you, and I'm like, what? How is that? What are you talking about? How is this connection never happened before? So I'm thankful to you and for you. Again, we appreciate the time so much. Thank you, sir.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
All right, man. All right, anytime. You be good.
All right, thank you.
See you. All right. Yeah, Rodney said the brother cooks. Don't say Rodney. We may have to hook that up. Next time we out there, we might have to sit down and do some things. There's some other stuff going on at home, obviously. The Democrats teamed up with the Republicans and got rid of the Speaker of the House. McCarthy is down. I didn't see it coming. I did not think that they were going to be bold enough to flip the coin and see who they wound up with. But with Jim Jordan seemingly gaining some steam, I'm even more concerned about the future of the House. Rodney, what do you think? You think Jim Jordan will make a good speaker?
Lee, I don't even know how you fix your mouth to ask that question. But because it's you, I'm going to take it easy on you. you know I don't use profane language, but I was thinking H-E-double-two-picks, no. He will further destroy the institution of the House. He will continue the insurrection of our government. And as far as I'm concerned, you add that on to the fact that he ignored players who were being sexually abused and assaulted during his tenure as one of the assistant wrestling coaches. He needs to be in jail. And the 14th Amendment is applicable to him just like it is to X-45.
Mm. If you don't know Jim Jordan, Jim Jordan is the co-founder of the Freedom Caucus. Jim Jordan, where do you even begin? He's from Ohio. He represents Ohio's 4th District. Yes, he is a insurrectionist. He is, I'm not going to say alleged. Yes, he is an insurrectionist. He is definitely in Trump's pocket. I don't know what traction could be gained on any law through the House that actually makes sense for the American populace as a whole with Jim Jordan as the Speaker of the House. I think this will be Benghazi on steroids with the Hunter Biden crap that's going on, because, again, Hunter Biden has, besides DNA, absolutely nothing to do with his father's legislative decision. So I think that will continue to be, I think that there will be another attempt at impeachment, and I say another because I don't think this is going to work. When your factual, quote-unquote, witnesses come on and say they have no facts, that's a problem. They have no evidence, that's a problem. So I think there will be a second impeachment hearing. And I think that will be the course up into and through the election, to be honest. It's just going to be deflection, 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 deflection versus focusing on the issues at hand. Gas prices being ridiculous. There will be no acknowledgement whatsoever that the Karen administration is working on controlling pharmaceutical prices, and pharmaceutical companies have agreed to at least sit down at the table for negotiations. I think that what we will continue to hear and see a whole bunch of, how do you say it, Rodney? Bovine defecation. And this will be continued. We'll be talking about voter ID, which we know is unnecessary. We'll be talking about everything except for the things that we need to talk about if this dude is actually elected to the other side. Do the Republicans give up the seat and play the Democrats in position or hopes of taking advantage of what they already know is a faulty government right now? So not allowing anything to pass. I'm sorry, allowing things to pass and then pointing them saying they're in control. This is why you have a problem. Or do they nominate somebody else who is a total dark horse but gives some concessions to the Freedom Caucus and or can get more Democratic support without having to go through it? I don't know, man. This is going to be very dicey. And you're talking about a stopgap resolution that was 45 days long. So this is not the time to be playing at all. We're pushed up against Thanksgiving with the stopgap measure being 45 days long. And if they don't get it right, again, you're going to be pushed up against Christmas and the New Year. And nobody needs to be going through all this bull crap as Christmas rolls around and into the year. So, I don't know. Thomas, what you think?
Well, my opinion on it is simple. Ding dong, the witch is dead. And McCarthy ate the bullet, thank God. I think that I'll go back to the pork barrel spending, man. They have nothing that is forcing them to work on the behalf of the people. We keep placing a morality cloud over some immoral people. They don't care.
Right.
They don't care. They just care about the power and the position. And you are right. You know, they're talking about everything but the things that the people need. And I think this goes back to some of the stuff you guys have been talking about with the shortening of the work week. I know locally they're saying the new affordable housing lingo will be about land trust home ownership. That's going to be the new wave of ownership throughout the country because they know there's not a lot of money that's going to be floating out of here in the U.S. in the next few decades. So I think that a lot of the distraction is happening on the congressional and Senate level. Now, what I find interesting, you all, is what's going on with Feinstein and that seat out there in California, and who Gavin Newsom put in place compared to who the Democrats, especially the Congressional Black Caucus, wanted. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm building on that. I'm with you with that. Keep going.
Well, I'm always finding these token Negroes that they put in the position. There's always
token lesbian.
Well, that's really what it is. A lot of times there are the black and lesbian, black and gay, black married to a white spouse, and you say, well, dang, do you serve anything without NutraSweet? And I found that pretty much interesting, just from the place of posturing on Gavin Newsom. And now ask you guys, do you feel this would be a sign to come if he was elected as president? Would he be one of those people who gave us more window dressing than actual dealing with policy? Because it seems like that's what he's good at doing in California.
I don't know about him taking his Californiasm to Washington and what that would look like. I'm really on the fence. I think he's playing politics with most of his moves in the fact that he's trying to keep himself more middle of the road than anybody to look like he has that type of reach. I think we will see who he really is in the debate and the vetting process. If he gets to that point, I think that will expose more about him than anything, because obviously he's going to have to take some turns no pun intended, some switches to his approach, because he still has to swing south, and you still have to pick up those votes in the South, as many as you can, and even in the Midwest to a degree. So everything that's done in California will not work nationwide, and he's going to have to make some tough decisions in the very near future to start crafting himself to appeal as a national figure. You know what I'm saying? Now, obviously,
you want to hear the list of people who are primed to replace him?
To replace him? You talking about California?
Yeah, his name, Representative, I'm talking about McCarthy. Steve Scalise from Louisiana, Republican. Jim Jordan, Republican, Ohio. Kevin Hern, Oklahoma, Republican. Elise Stefanik probably, New York, Republican. Byron Donald, Florida, Republican, and former President Donald Trump.
Did you
Trump.
Say Byron Coon? Did you say Byron?
Byron Donald. Byron Donald. You coming out? He coming out punching today. Byron Donald of the Florida Republicans, and Donald Trump. So there's a list of people that they already have that they've made allegiances with that have sworn not to break them if they put them in that seat. And it could potentially one day be X-45 if that list is that short. And they didn't got down to Byron. What you say, Byron C? C short for Coon. Donald's. Then who knows? So those kind of moves being made should make us nervous, though, in my opinion. They're actually shifting, reorienting, shuffling that power because they found that there's a division, right, Rodney? There, you either with X45 or you ain't. You either want old-time Republicanism in the day, the Ronald Reagan-esque, even probably back before that, or you want this new weird hybrid Republicanism. And that what we're looking at is a rift. We should be, I guess, a little excited, in my opinion, because there's definitely some changes happening within that realm of Politico. So what can we do? Can we start talking to our fellow people about politics again and swaying them for the upcoming election? Because we have one coming, right? Mr. Rodney, don't we have an election coming up soon?
Yeah, next year. The most important election of my lifetime is coming up because all elections are the most important. But this one right here will potentially, if we do not elect the right people, us black people and maybe people in general may not have to worry about any other elections. That's why when I hear people say, no, we're not going to vote because they'll want our vote. No, if we don't vote, for sure, there will be people elected that will do harm to us specifically as black people, but may dismantle the institution that has perpetuated the ideas of democracy. And that is not only dangerous for us as black people, it's dangerous for us as a country, but it's dangerous for the world because Putin is on the move. Russia wants to be on the move. Thank God we're sending a whole bunch of money over there and the Ukrainians are kicking his tail because if it wasn't for that, shucks, they might be trying to get me and Lee to reenlist to come and fight that war. And I don't want to go for stupidity. So, and you know, if they're calling us up, we're in trouble. So this money well spent, and Jim Jordan is talking about cutting off the money for that. Putin has already said he's looking at five other countries to invade. You know, once a bully starts advancing, a bully will advance until there's nobody left to advance on. And that's what we're dealing with Putin. President Biden understands that. But Jim Jordan nor Scalise seems to understand that. And keep in mind that Scalise said that he was David Duke minus the baggage of the KKK.
Hold on. I appreciate that we swung back to the House, but I don't want to undercut what Thomas was proposing with the Senator Feinstein replacement. You know, Thomas, again, going back to your point about having this, I stand by my statement earlier. I think that we'll see who he really is during the debate. I can't recall because I've read too much stuff this week. Who did the black caucus want, the congressional black caucus want to replace her?
They want a Senator Boxer, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
I thought they wanted either Barbara Lee or I believe it's Tammy Bass, but one of them was Barbara Lee. Is what the congressional
they wanted Barbara Lee. My bad, brother. I said Barbara Boxer. My apologies. It was Barbara Lee, and I understand why they wanted Barbara Lee. They wanted somebody with some long term. They didn't want a person just for a short period of time that will probably not run in the election for the seat. And the symbolism. I think this is the one thing that I feel like the CBC has been being. You know, kind of clowned about in our community, but I don't think our folks really get it. I think the CBC is tired of the symbolism politics. They're tired of the tokenism that white folks keep doing in these positions. They know that, and we know this in our community, we got talented people of all walks of life. And I got into a deep argument this week with a close friend of mine, and I'm like, when white people start choosing, they always choose a type. And when that type is always called up to me, it's always problematic because that means that they are picking our leaders versus us choosing who we want to lead. And so that's what I had an issue with his pick, because if you're gonna pick someone not based off of trying to appeal to special interest groups so they catapult your career down the line, you know?
Right. Okay. That's fair enough. It was interesting to me they picked her because, first off, she was a resident of Washington, D.C. She does have a residence in California as well, but her primary residence was in Washington, D.C. Secondly, where the hell did her name just crop up from? Like, why her? Again, when you had other folks that were more qualified.
It's that House of Cards. You ain't never watched House of Cards? Do you remember that?
I did, but you do have what's the boy name? He's actually in Congress right now. He intends to run for that seat next year. So I don't think he wanted to put someone in that would have actually given him a fight. He was the one that was censured by the House, right? The House earlier this year. His name is something. I see his face. I can't think of his name right now. I'm sorry. Again, I've read too much stuff this week. Sometimes it all jumbles together. And I know we were going to take this turn, so I didn't come prepared for it. For that question. But no matter what, we are at a moment where shit needs to get done, really, because these kids are demanding change. Unions, the resurgence of unions is cropping up. I think they are going to play a major role in this upcoming election. Big time. I'm not seriously. I'm talking big time. I'm thinking you're going to get folks voting that have not voted in a long time. This go around. I think you're going to see more and more folks from the union pounding the pavement like they did in yesteryear to support whatever candidates they decide to support. In addition to that, with the continuance of election interference cases and all the other court appearances that Donald Trump has going on right now, while he has a solid block, I think that as more people flip on him, they're going to be fissures in that block, because it's going to be important not only for Republicans to win the presidency, they need to win down ballot as well. And I think folks are going to recognize they can't do that with Trump. They can't. So I think they will sacrifice him to win down ballot and control whatever they can control at the state level and let the Fed do what it is for another 4 years and then come back at it at that point. So I believe Nikki Haley is going to be the biggest victor in all of this, because I truly believe she'll be the nominee in 2028 unless someone else comes out of the woodwork, which is possible, but I think she'll be the nominee in 2028. And the Democrats better come ready, because the Republicans will be ready to come out in full force to vote for her. They will. That's my take. We got 5 minutes left. Rashi, what you got to say?
Well, I want you to know that I have got the scores back for my children. And it's not looking good. And I want you to know that if you know a child, if you see a child, if you're around a child, if you know somebody who got a child, and you got any kind of discretionary income, get them a book. I'm playing with y'all no more. Our children are suffering for what they do not know. So if you're serious about it and you really want to make a concerted effort about the mindset and the cognition of tomorrow's people. You absolutely have to reach out to these children and be a support base for what they need, because if you don't know what's happening, if you don't know how we're relaxing standards, how parents are homeschooling at an ever-increasing rate, how we're not socializing children, we're almost back to the pre-segregation type population, where children in the exact same classroom cannot even get the same education from the same individual. Please go find a child and ask them what you need. It might be staples. It might be a textbook. It might be a program. It might be a whole computer, for real. But I don't know what it is. But if we don't fix it, we in trouble. I'm telling you now, I got fifth graders reading on a kindergarten level, and they don't have no IEP plan. They just out there floating around in the ether, staring at me like I'm a comedy show. So please, please, please find a young person and make them learn something somehow, support them through some type of learning process. We in trouble. That's all I can say. And I love you all. And I love you all, and I'm so glad. Happy 11 years. How you doing?
Thomas, what you got?
Oh, man, I just got Nas and Wu-Tang tonight, man. Hey, enjoy your life. Enjoy your Saturday. Do it up and do it big.
Okay. Brother Rodney, what you got?
Ditto for Sister Rashi on the reading part. The upcoming elections, the school board elections, please do not sleep on it. They're coming for your children. They're coming for our future. So please pay attention to those school board races. Put people up that really represent us, represent our culture, because they are coming. A big shout out to Lee, Sister Rashi, and some of the original hosts for having this show on the air for this long. Anytime you're a decade or more, you've made a mark, and you're still making it, brother. So you and Sister Rashi, keep on doing what you do.
Thank you. Look, a special moment for the families impacted by the shooting at Morgan State University. Morgan State University was right around the corner from my high school, literally. I could walk from the campus of Morgan State to my high school in about 5 minutes. It is right around the corner from where I used to live at. Again, literally, I could walk there probably 15, 20 minutes. That instance when there was an active shooting at Morgan State University, there was no death, as I'm understood, just injuries. But again, the attack itself is just ridiculous, and we definitely need to do better, especially as enrollment at HBCUs are increasing greatly. We definitely need to take care of our children. Our children are our future, without a doubt. Hey, y'all, thank you. Again, 11 years and counting. We're going to keep it rolling. It's time. For those listening now, those listening later, share, tell a friend, click, like us, follow us, Facebook, Instagram, X, you know it, that's where we are. If ain't nobody told you, we love you, ain't a damn thing you can do about it, y'all. Until next week, peace!